Food Talk with Mike Colomeco is brought to you by Cento Fine Foods at cento.com, that's C-E-N-T-O.com, and King Arthur Flour at kingarthurflour.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, folks. Welcome. Hey, back on the radio again. Nice. Welcome to the new show here, Michael Meko's Food Talk on Heritage Radio Network. If you're inclined to get a hold of us today, we'd be happy to talk to you or take your questions over the internet. You just visit us at heritageradionetwork.org, and you'll figure it out because you're all computer savvy and smart. And if you're really old school and you have a telephone, there actually is a phone line, although I'm probably the only one that ever uses it here. It's 1-718-497-2128. Again, that's 718-497-2128. The show is Food Talk with Mike Colomeco. Pleasure to be here live over the internet and doing radio out of Bushwick, Brooklyn. I don't know. I felt like the oldest guy on the train coming over here, but that'll happen on the L train once it crosses the river. Anyway, it's a fun show today. I have a great guest coming up in just a couple of minutes. I had her on my old radio show. She's the head of the New York, how am I pronouncing this, Mycological Society. We're going to talk about mushroom foraging, about pickling. And this is great for me because I'm just back from a trip, my first trip actually, to Poland. I've been to Europe, I don't know, 50, 60 times over the years, but usually the same places. Yeah, France, Italy, Spain. Been to Portugal a few times, and Poland was never on my radar, but became interested in it and saw the whole country in about 12 days. We went from Bialystok, which was great. The street I live on now, down on the Lower East Side, is Bialystoker Way, which is pretty cool. It's named after Bialystok. We have the big Bialystoker synagogue across the street. My front's on Grand, my back's on Broom, but the real name of the alley is Bialystoker Way. So I got to go see where the Bialy came from and the last restaurant that's actually still making them. Got to see a ton of people making pierogies and kielbasa and sausage and all that stuff, which you expect. Drank way too much vodka and beer, but saw some great mushroom foraging, which really got me thinking about mushroom. And also got to work with one of my tour guide's mothers, Mamushka, she's affectionately referred to as, probably in her mid-70s now, who made a great lunch for us, showed me how to make pierogies, and got me into pickling, which we're going to talk about too, Eugenia, you and I. Yeah, she makes her own dill pickles. She had them sitting on the table. And since pickles are so hip these days, right, everyone's doing this stuff, sort of the DIY movement now, with people doing their own thing with, you know, pickles in their kitchen, bitters in their kitchen, kimchi in their kitchen. I've actually made kimchi before, too, but we'll get to that later. Anyway, let me bring Eugenia on. Eugenia, welcome.
Hey, Mike.
Pleasure to have you in person. I had you. I guess you were one of my regular weekend guests with the old show, which meant that I was home on Sunday in Cape May, not in New York, and you were on the phone, so we've never met.
No, this is the first time.
Pleasure. So tell me, so you're what is your title? Because I always get stuff like this wrong.
I'm the president of the New York Mycological Society.
And how many members are there?
We're 300 plus. We're actually growing. Society was started in its current incarnation 50 years ago by John Cage and some compatriots.
John Cage?
Yeah, yeah.
Like the composer?
The composer.
No way.
Yeah, yeah, we're cool.
Wow, aside being a great musician who's into mushrooms. So tell us what you do, because, I mean, every time I talked, when I used to email you to, like, schedule dates to do recordings, half the time you'd be, no, I'm in Colorado hunting for mushrooms, or I'm in Northern California that week, or I'm somewhere else doing something. So that's part of your yearly schedule, is these treks in and around New York, which you do, but also out of state.
Yeah, whenever I can. You know, it's sort of, I pretend it's work, but it's really not.
Yeah, I do the same thing. That's right. Don't tell anybody. And what got you in? I know I asked you this before, but one more time. What got you into mushrooms, which is, I mean, who wouldn't be? They're amazing things to eat. But what got you into the idea of foraging for them back in the day?
Well, I mean, I'm of Italian extract, so my father's an Italian. So Italians forage. I mean, we didn't ski or sail or do anything sporty. We looked for food by the side of the road. But mainly I got in because of gluttony. You know, I just wanted to be an effective mushroom hunter. And it was through a study of the mycology that I got turned on to an aspect of nature, really this sort of grand complexity of nature that had been beyond me before then. And it turned me on to biology in general, but mycology in particular. So that sounds really nerdy, and it is, actually, but it's a very fulfilling subject because it touches on much more than food, also environment.
And yeah, and it gets you out doing something. Because, I mean, it's funny. There's this whole movement now that, I mean, everybody thinks they invented everything. I guess when we were hippies in the 60s
certainly
or
in
70s.
Food.
Yeah, in food. But in food now, you see this sort of DIY thing and this sort of urban foraging, and you see it a lot on menus. And I guess maybe the guy that sort of brought it front and center was the chef Rene at Noma in Copenhagen, who does an awful lot of this. It sort of came from the Scandinavian countries, and now it's you're seeing it in New York restaurants. I had an amazing meal at a wonderful restaurant called Amaro. It was the first restaurant in Poland ever to get a Michelin star. Wojciech Amaro is the chef, and he was amazing. And he was using all Polish ingredients to begin with, which was kind of a cool thing because, I mean, Poland has a little bit of ocean to the top, a lot of lakes, pretty diverse landscape. But his idea was to cook in season, and he kept track of lists of ingredients. He's really into cooking like by the week, not by the season, but by the week. And according to him, the 37th or 38th week of the year, which was mid-September, in Poland, he has 500 and some ingredients that he was using. So it was amazing.
Beautiful.
And he was really into the whole idea of Polish and mushrooms and stuff, and we saw tons of people out. It pretty much rained every day we were there. I think the fall is usually a kind of mushroom season in Europe to begin with. And we saw so many people out foraging. So where do you go when you're around here? Do you go, you're upstate, you're in Jersey?
The society, the New York Mycological Society, hunts places we can get to by mass transit. So all the parks, we do some events that you have to carpool to, but those tend to be regular annual events. Our morel weekend, where we hunt our spot for morels in May, and then we have a chanterelle weekend, and you know, things, events like that. But by and large, we're hunting. You know, we're here, we're there. You don't see us, but we're looking under the trees and cemeteries and so on. Right now, we're hunting for the maitake, the Grifola frondosa, which is a wonderful culinary mushroom. It grows under oak trees, and people are finding them. I saw some yesterday that some folks brought to a lecture I did, that gorgeous, fluffy maitake mushrooms.
From where? Yeah. From New York? From Jersey? From Pennsylvania?
Tri-state region, yeah. But there's a Connecticut Mycological Society. I mean, there's a New Jersey Mycological Society. So there's... Every state has at least one, it seems, mycological society. I mean, they're all over.
And some of these mushroom, like you're mentioning, maitake specifically, have some sort of synergistic relationship with oak. They like to grow around oak. Because I know the same thing happens with some of the truffles that grow around scrub oaks or in vineyards, and or the white truffle in northern Italy specifically.
Well, okay, now we're going to get into mycology.
Get geeky.
A little bit, all right? So truffles, they are the fruiting bodies of a fungus that grows on the roots of certain trees and shrubs.
That's the link.
Whereas the maitake, or the hen of the woods, Latin is Grifola frondosa, and you can see them cultivated in the stores, but the wild version grows around here at the base of oak trees, and they are saprobes, which means that the fungus eats dead and dying things. The fungus itself is probably consuming a dying root of the oak tree and producing a mushroom when it's time to get the hell out of there and find another oak tree. It's also considered mildly parasitic. So these different categories, the root fungus, the saprobes that eat dead and dying, we've created these categories, but nature has a lot of blurry lines. Nature doesn't actually color in the lines that we create.
Mm. You know, it's funny you mentioned Italian and your father and grandfather. I grew up in West Philadelphia for the most part, and my grandma was an amazing cook. She was kind of like my inspiration, and was home all the time cooking, and her husband, my grandfather, was a tailor during the week. And right adjacent to their row house was a golf course, a public golf course, a city golf course. And he and his buddies would go out on that golf course all the freaking time.
Yeah.
And they would be pulling these fungus off of trees, these things that weighed like a pound and a half, 2 pounds, and other mush. I mean, they kind of knew from back in the day from Italy what to pick and what they could eat and what they couldn't. And dandelions, I mean, all sorts of stuff that, as you said, I mean, literally, that's kind of how I grew up eating, too.
Yeah, Yeah, that's the Italian way, and it's also the Eastern Europe. I mean, it's just all our sort of European ancestors' way. You know, it just all got forgotten post World War II, I think, for a while. But that was, we have to look at that era, the whole canned food. You know,
yeah,
that was an aberration.
You know, it was
that shouldn't have happened. It did, but now we're going to move past that. Everybody seems to be more interested in local foods and garden foods and foods they find by the road.
I look at this little radio station here at Heritage, and it kind of cracks me up because the when I first met Patrick Martins, who founded Heritage, I was doing Food Talk at WOR, and I mean, what you just said, I mean, I sort of grew up in the dark ages of, I mean, I'm 57, so I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and it was like, you know, housewives didn't want to cook anymore. Our grandparents were great, but then the next generation was sort of post-World War II, supermarkets came in, convenience was the word of the day. I mean, if John Glenn drank Tang, which was powdered orange juice, if it was good enough for the astronauts, it was good enough for us, and it really was like, we just went off the rails food-wise. We went into this black hole for the better part of 3 or 4 decades, and it's great to see these kids today are stoked about food.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, speaking of stoked about food, you're listening to Mike Lemico's Food Talk on Heritage Radio Network. You can get a hold of us at heritageradionetwork.org if you want. My guest for this segment is Eugenia Bone, who I'm finally getting to meet in person. Met you on the radio a bunch of times in the past. You brought some stuff with you today. Thanks so much. There is a little baggie in front of me. It's a Ziploc baggie with some dried brown mushrooms, and I can smell them through the baggie. What's up with these
All
things?
Right.
What
Don't
are
get
they?
The wrong idea. They're not blue stainers. So what these are they're called candy caps. They're part of a group of mushrooms that are found in Northern California, and I go once every 2 years or so to pick them. They are a mycorrhizal fungi, so they grow in association with certain shrubs, and they have a very, very distinctive smell of maple syrup.
That's exactly what it is.
Isn't
Why?
It awesome?
Why? Almost that caramelly, but it is, I mean, almost like artificial may, like Aunt Jemima, like that kind of that strong.
It's so intense. And so it's used when it's usually dried and then used in sweet applications. So, for example, these mushrooms, which you should take home, soak them. And then with the liquid and the mushrooms, make a simple syrup, you know, add sugar and cook it down until it's a little bit thick. And it's a fantastic simple syrup to use with panna cotta or cheesecake or rice pudding, anything sort of bland that allows that mushroom to be the star. It's pretty exotic, a sweet mushroom. You know, it's kind of far out.
And so when you go out to forage these, what month of the year?
January is when I find them. I actually go to Soma Camp. Which is really
I think you
fun.
Told me about this.
It's the
You
Sonoma.
Pick mushrooms all day and party at night. How's this going?
Yeah,
you told me about this
Well,
before.
They're all the mushroom festivals all over the country. Well, they tend to be pick mushrooms during the day, hear lectures in the evening, party after that kind of situation. They're really fun. So Soma Camp is the Sonoma Mycological Association, and they throw a 3-day event. I think it's over Martin Luther King weekend in Sonoma. And folks hunt mushrooms, go on forays during the day, and then have lectures, and the food and wine is fantastic, and there's a lot of socializing and so on. So these candy caps we find at Soma Camp. This year I'm actually going to be presenting, but that's what they call their speakers and people who do seminars and so on. I'll always take some time out to hunt the mushroom.
What's in season right here now? You were talking to me before. So we have maitake.
The maitake is in now. People are finding the Spirasis crispa, which is the cauliflower mushroom, which is a pretty fantastic white mushroom, very feathery. And the honey mushrooms are coming up. And further north, chanterelles, I guess. I don't know if they're finished yet.
Yeah, we saw those in Poland. Chanterelles were all over the place in Poland. Do we have anything like a sep, like a boletus that we're growing in America?
Yes, you can find boletus in Cape Cod, you know, and all the way up north, you can find boletus in the, you know, boletus is the family name, so there's a whole bunch of different ones.
Okay.
When people say porcini, they're talking about, just like when they say candy cap, they're talking about a group of mushroom or species. Likewise, when they say porcini, they're talking about a group of species. But the number one, the best, is the king bolete, or the boletus edulis. And that particularly flavorful mushroom can be found all over the United States, but most deliciously. And so the strain is, like, particularly fabulous in the Colorado Rockies.
No kidding. Lucky
oh,
them.
Yeah. It is awesome. And there is just some heavy picking going on there. This summer was a great year. And there was there were people all over the mountains taking. I heard that they were the picker, commercial pickers were taking 20,000 pounds a week.
Whoa!
Out of the
That's a lot.
West Elk Mountains.
That's a lot of baskets of mushrooms. That's crazy.
And they're big and heavy and delicious. So these pickles I brought you, they're actually marinated, so they're not as strong. These are Boletus edulis that I collected in the Rockies.
And this is another thing you do, and we're going to get into this in a couple of minutes. Canning, jarring, pickling, which is another thing people seem to be crazy about these days.
Yeah, yeah, I'm a long time doer of such things. For me, it's just a way to have like fast, good food in the winter. Everything I do, I guess it's unfortunate, but it all really derives from gluttony. So I put up foods because I like not for. Unfortunately, it's not really for like good sort of environmental reasons, but because the food tastes better. That's why I do it.
So, but I mean, that's like the mother of invention with food since the beginning, right? I mean, the Koreans did kimchi for a reason because cabbage was a late harvest crop. And once cabbage was done, there was nothing until the next spring.
Yeah.
And so you think of the French with confit, you think of everybody preserved. I mean, there's sort of the, from the beginning, I mean, the whole idea of making sausage or boudinois, what do you slaughter a pig? What do you do with all the parts? How do we turn this into stuff so we can use pre-refrigeration?
Yeah. It just makes the good stuff that you eat in season
last longer.
Usable, you know, and the benefits are, of course, great because it means that you keep your dollars local all year round. And my thing is I just look at my refrigerator and look at my life and say, you know, what do I eat a lot of? And that's what I can a lot of. And what I don't eat a lot of, I just, you know, maybe do, like, I don't eat a lot of strawberry jam. You know, I'm not five. So I'll have, you know, I'll make 2 half pints of strawberry jam. That's enough to last me. But other foods like marinated mushrooms or, you know, marinated peppers, things like that, that I really use in a lot of different dishes, I make tons of.
Pepper, like roast peppers, like black, like burnt, peel the skin kind of peppers?
Yeah. Actually, I chop them up really fine and preserve them in a marinade. There's some USDA recipes. There is for these mushrooms, too, although it's not for wild mushrooms, of course. So we're going to take our lives a little bit in.
I'll trust you with this.
Yeah. We'll taste it and close our eyes and hope all goes well. But, yeah, the marinated, the little chopped up marinated peppers are fabulous. I just dump that jar into a bunch of oven roasted chicken parts and
it's a meal.
It's to die for. It's just great. It's got so much flavor and it takes me 2 minutes.
You've got a book coming out soon, don't you, on pickling or canning or something?
Well, it's called The Kitchen Ecosystem and it comes out in next summer, you know, so August 2014. And what it talks about is really figuring out what food you like to eat. And so it's the book, which has got 400 plus recipes, are the foods that I eat. They're more Mediterranean diet, you know. So it's not a kitchen ecosystem for a Thai cook. It's a kitchen ecosystem for a Italian, French, Greek kind of Mediterranean cook. And so I look at all the foods that I would eat and then have recipes for eating them fresh, have recipes for preserving them, utilizing the preserves, utilizing the waste streams to create byproducts that bump up the flavor of the next meal. What you guys do in a professional kitchen all the time. But your home cooks can do that too if you just take a good look at what you like to eat. It's not such an onerous task. And then also it has recipes for the condiments that are useful to me. So I use Worcestershire sauce. Like, a bottle will last me 6 years, so I don't really need to make that. But something like mayonnaise, I eat all the time. So I make it once a week, and I have the mayonnaise on hand.
So you make homemade mayonnaise, egg yolk.
Yep.
Drizzle in oil, the usual standard.
Just emulsify.
Right. Classic, you know? Old school recipe.
Yeah. And I put a little water in there to hold it, you know.
Loosens it up a little bit. If that emulsion gets too tight, it wants some water to add.
But it also keeps it from separating while you refrigerate. So, it holds for whatever, 5 days. It's perfect.
Yeah, I got to tell you, I'm lazy. The only thing I make that is in the summer that I keep for the year is towards the end of, I guess by mid-September, down in Cape May, tourists are gone. Farms are still really productive, but they've got no place to sell their wares to, because the bulk of the people have left town. And the plum tomatoes are just full on. Tomatoes are just producing like crazy. And by that point, you can get a bushel of tomatoes for $4 or $5. And I still have this ritual of sort of every September, going to the farm, buying a bushel and a half of tomatoes, washing them, cutting them in half, getting one of my huge rondos from my old restaurant days, covering every burner on the stove, cranking the thing up until it's blue hot, little garlic, little onion, little basil, all tomatoes, and they just collapse. You know, they just break down, stir it around. Takes maybe half an hour, 40 minutes till they're, quote, cooked. I mean, they really don't have to cook. They just sort of break down. And then I cool them, put them through a food mill to get the skin out, and just freeze that tomato sauce in little containers for, you know, last years, actually.
Yeah.
But I feel terrible, because why aren't I doing this with corn? Why aren't I doing this with all sorts of stuff? And I should be.
Well, I think the thing that I try to do, I do in my life, so that's what I do in my book. I'm not one of these people that has lunch with their agent and then decides what's on trend. You know, I just do what I really
do. Good, thank you. That's why you're here.
Well, thanks. So I just do small amounts. So, for example, if I'm going to have a tomato salad for dinner in September, then I'll buy an extra pound of tomatoes, and I'll put up one or two pints at the same time as I'm making dinner and hanging around the kitchen anyway. It's just one more burner acting on the stove. I never do a huge half a day of putting up foods. It's just not my thing. I do small batches constantly. I just, whenever I'm in the kitchen, I'm never doing one thing. I'm always, and I don't use a garbage can, I use a stock pot, you know. Everything gets thrown in there, and that, so I'll be making stock at the same time. Even if I have 2 cups of mushroom stems, so I'll make a pint of mushroom stock. So what? Yeah. A pint is nice to have.
Yeah.
Next time I need water for a meat dish, instead of putting in water, I put in the mushroom stock. Tastes better.
Yeah, it's fine. You know, we're sort of creatures of habit, and I like to buy whole birds in New York City. Cape May is great for seafood. It's great in season for produce and stuff, but off season it's tough. So I bring back a lot of things from Manhattan to the Cape May house, and most of the time that's where my meat comes from places like Patrick Martin's Heritage Meat Market and the Essex Street Market. I used to shop at Dixon's Farm Stand over in Chelsea. Jake's got a beautiful New York State grass-fed organic, just wonderful. You're supporting local farms. It's really healthy. It's delicious.
Right.
Cheap,
tastes
it's not,
better.
But it's wonderful. And he had great birds. Anyway, without getting long-winded, I'd love to buy fresh whole chickens, either that Bobo-style Chinese chicken, or Jake had a really good halal chicken at Dixon's. And when I take them home, just like you're saying, if I don't roast them whole and I'm butchering the parts, I make a stock, like instantly. Just one chicken carcass or two chicken carcasses, hack them up, put them in a pot, fill it up with water, hour and a half, 2 hours later, let it reduce down, strain it, and I've got chicken stock for the next time I want to do something where I want flavor.
Yeah.
I mean, what am I going to do with that carcass? Throw it out? It just seems stupid.
Exactly. And it's really, the small amounts are key, because that's what that says. That's why this ecosystem metaphor works, is because that's about diversity. A lot of small amounts make a more complex kitchen ecosystem than having tons of one thing. You know, I mean, it's like, for me, all right, some people are going to call in and say, I love strawberry jam, stop picking on strawberries. But, you know, you can do 12 things of strawberry, you know, 12 half pints of strawberry jam. But why do that when you can have 2 half pints of strawberry jam that you did at the same time as you were making dinner, and then 2 half pints of fig jam that you did at the same time as you were making dinner, and so on. That diversity takes less effort and gives you a much more stuff to play with.
Varied palate to play with.
And also kind of helps you figure out what you like, what you're good at, what you can find, because some years the figs are great and the strawberries suck, you know, it just depends.
Yeah, it's true. And I know it's like peaches. Some years, I mean, that's a really finicky fruit to grow, and I guess 4 or 5 years ago, we had a great peach season in Jersey, and you just couldn't get a bad peach anywhere, white or yellow.
That's the time to go crazy.
And then you'll have years when you just can't get a good peach, period.
Yeah,
and tomatoes are the same
way. So
they talk about Jersey tomatoes, and that always cracks me up, because Jersey has so many different soil types and so many climates, and from the north to the south and the east, there is no Jersey tomato per se. And they're really hard, finicky things to grow. You know, they like a little bit of rain, not too much. They don't like too cool nights, but it can't be too hot. They don't like, I mean, there's all these balls in the air during tomato season. And we're just, you know, from January till July, we're dreaming of those freaking tomatoes.
Yeah, yeah. But so then, you know, like the Italian mentality would be, or at least the way I grew up would be, so you don't have that many tomatoes that year, you know?
Yeah.
They might be a lot of zucchini. You might be eating zucchini instead.
There's always a lot of zucchini. Again, my guest is Eugenia Bone. What's the book that you have out? What is the title of the book on mushrooms?
Mycophilia, which just comes from the Greek myco, meaning mushroom, and philia being loving. So it's mushroom loving. Mycophilia.
Without asking like a crazy question, but we know that there's toxic mushrooms out there. Mm-hmm. In fact, I know that there's one that looks like a morel that's a false morel in Europe.
Yeah, Gyromitra.
Right, that people, I mean, every year in Europe, because they're so much more into foraging than we are, there are people, dozens of people that die from eating the wrong species or making mistakes. How many species in this country are dangerous to eat?
Well, it's a sliding scale. I mean, inebriators are considered poisonous mushrooms, right? Like psilocybin mushrooms. But there's only about six that'll sort of take out your liver or your kidney. And it's good to know those. It's not hard to learn. If you're into mushrooms, you can learn 20 edibles and six poisonous. I mean, I try to learn a few poisonous mushrooms at the same, you know, one a year or whatever, just so that that's part of the overall picture of understanding this, the field of, you know, field mycology. But it's not that big a deal. You just, it's like berries. You know, the ones you know, and the ones that you know are poisonous, you avoid. And if you don't know, don't eat it. It's that kind of thing.
So if I've got mushrooms, because I have this happens all summer long. I was telling you before we went on live that there was I was running on the beach at home down at Cape May, and I couldn't believe it. I mean, the things I see on the beach, like deer prints. I'm like, what the hell is a deer doing on the beach? And all those rabbits running around. It's nature. Not to mention a bazillion birds. But there were these little mushrooms coming up out of the sand. And I'm like, I got to – because I never have my iPhone with me. And if I did, I'm not the type of person to take pictures, but that would be the thing to do. But I'm thinking, you're the person I'd ask. And I pick – I mean, they're tiny, but I remember picking them up and smelling them, and they smelled so good. And as I described them to you, you said, yeah, Mike, we call those LBMs. I'm like, what's that stand for? Little brown mushrooms.
Yeah. We get a lot of those.
Yeah. But how would I know in my backyard in Cape May after it rains, I'll just see her across the street and some growing out of the grass will be these big, fat, plump mushrooms that weren't there the day before.
Yeah.
Probably won't be there the next day.
Yeah.
If I want to eat those, what should I do? Is there a website that I would go to? Would I be
taking a
big chance?
IDs of that, you know, internet IDs and stuff like that can be tricky.
Yeah.
It's really the best thing to know to do if you want to learn about mushrooms in your vicinity is join your local mycological society, or at least make some connections with that mycological society. And what they'll do is during the season, they pick and they have ID sessions. So you attend an ID session or two and you find out what's growing. Right. And the experts are always aboard. There are always experts on these societies. I'm not one. I'm not an ID jock, but we have amazing experts in our group who will help you understand the mushrooms that you're collecting and seeing.
Yeah, and you told me you got a couple of times a year where you guys are around Jersey too, aren't you?
Oh yeah, but New Jersey has a fantastic club.
Yeah,
at least one, and so does Connecticut. I mean, it's in every state.
Gotcha.
I can't think of a state where there isn't.
Gotcha. All right. Talk to me. One quick question about pickling. So I came home. I was in a friend of mine's mother's house, her apartment outside of Warsaw. Great lady. And she had, and I've got these too, the pickles you use for making, the cucumbers used for making pickles. The kind of warty ones that are a little shorter than your average salad variety. And I asked, she had a ball jar on the table, her dining room table, and in it was sort of pickles this way, stacked up the way you would firewood, some garlic, clearly some dill blossoms. And I asked her how she made them, and it was like the simplest thing. She didn't speak English, but it was like sign language. It was a tablespoon of salt.
Uh-huh.
I think she boils her water before, adds the salt to make sure the salt dissolves in the water. And it wasn't much. It was like, for that size jar, which I would guesstimate was a quart or so, tablespoon of salt, some water, a bunch of cloves of garlic, that's your call. And then I still have to find where I can buy dill blossoms, because it wasn't the herb dill. It was the long blossoms
the
and the sort of big stalks that were kind of gnarly and kind of.
So she was making dill cucumbers. I mean, dill pickles.
Right.
So they're called dills if they've
for
got
a
that
reason.
Flour in them. Yeah.
For a reason.
Yeah.
And so what's the stuff? What's the secret with those things? It's just that? It's just that simple?
The word pickle comes from, I think it's the Dutch word for brine. They're that is a fermented pickle. So what's happening is that the salt and that's been watered down, you know, created into brine, it causes something called lactose fermentation, which creates that wonderful sour taste and increases the acidity of the cucumber so that it's safe to hold without going bad or without spoilers that could make you sick. And then the other kind of pickles is just a vinegar pickle. Yeah. Those often use salt as well, but not to ferment. That would be like a quick pickle. There's a zillion recipes for them. They're really safe. You can water bath can the end result. Sauerkraut is the same kind of lactose fermented pickle that your mother's friend is making, only it's cabbage.
So I went home and I made them. I went home and I just played around with some stuff, and I made one quick one where I sort of quartered the pickles so the absorption rate would be much higher, let that sit out only one day at room temperature, then I put it in the refrigerator to slow down the fermentation, and they came out really good. The other ones were kind of a mystery one because I had a big old lockdown jar, but I was missing the rubber gasket, so there's probably too much air in there, but whatever, I'm going to die. And it was,
yeah, they need to stay submerged, otherwise they get...
Well, they did, so otherwise they get mold, otherwise they get nasty, and that didn't happen. But I was watching them, because the other thing she said is it takes a couple of weeks for them to sort of ferment through.
Yeah.
That if you eat them, it's sort of like we used to call when I was a kid growing up in delis, there was a half sour and a full sour.
Exactly.
And the half sours were kind of green on the inside. I like the full sour pickles.
Yeah.
I was like the ones that are all the way through pickled. But I was wide. It was like a lab experiment because, like, the first couple of days, there's not much happening. And then there's bubbles. And then it got a little bit cloudy. And I could think it was, like, moving. I'm like, it's alive. It was like there was something happening in there. And actually, they came out. I was kind of scared. After 5 or 6 days, it was warm last week. I ended up putting them in the fridge to just sort of slow down the fermentation because I took one out and tasted it and thought, this is pretty much there now. But, I mean, so that's just a classic pickle. Classic sour.
And if you don't... can it, you know, water bath, process it so it's become shelf stable. Those good bacteria are fantastic for your body. I mean, they really are healthy for your digestion.
The probiotic thing they talk to with
absolutely.
Kimchi.
And I have friends who swear that if you have a tablespoon of, you know, a pickle product like a kimchi or a sauerkraut or pickles before a meal, that you'll lose weight. I'm all for that kind of program.
Yeah.
Anything that says no more wine at dinner is not going to work.
No, that's not going to work. No. So a little bit of pickle juice. And then go ahead and have the wine with dinner. And then go ahead and eat dinner.
And then have whatever you want.
And see if that works.
I'll have the cordon bleu.
Yeah, I like it. Okay. All right.
I'm trying it.
All right. My guess is...
We'll check back in 3 months and see if I've lost some weight.
You're actually trying this now?
Absolutely.
Oh, go girl. All right. Good for you. All right. My guest is Eugenia Bone. We're going to be back. We have to take a quick spot. You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. You can find us at heritageradionetwork.org. The show's Food Talk with Mike Colomeco. It's great to be here. Great to be in Bushwick. Great to be in New York City. The city we all love. We'll be back with a little bit more of this after a quick spot. Hey folks, Mike Colomeco here. When I'm at home and I want to make a great tomato sauce, well, it starts with shopping, and I always go for Cento brand San Marzano tomatoes. It comes from a region just outside of Naples in the foothills of Mount Vesuvius, where there's this amazing volcanic soil, a super clean high water table that the Greeks were raving about eons ago. It's a special place with a special microclimate, and it's really a unique tomato. It's kind of long and banana-shaped with a real thin skin, heavy, thick flesh wall, and not many seeds. It's the perfect canning tomato. So come mid-August, when the season's perfect, that's when they slow down the production, slow down the farming, and can the Cento San Marzano tomatoes. It's harvested with complete sustainability, and it's the best tomatoes, everybody agrees, for tomato sauce. All of Cento's San Marzano tomatoes, from the seeds to the fields to the farms to the production facility, are certified by an independent agency which guarantees the traceability. It's what I use when I want to make great tomato sauce at home. Cento San Marzano tomatoes.
King Arthur Flour, established in 1790, is America's oldest flour company. They're an employee-owned company whose passion is sharing the joy of baking and inspiring bakers worldwide. When King Arthur was founded in 1790, George Washington was the newly elected president of the United States. The company was sold by the Sands family to King Arthur Flour employees in 1996. They are now an ESOP company, 100% employee-owned, with a 100% commitment to quality. Visit them at kingarthurflour.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. Mike Colomeco here. The show is Mike Colomeco's Food Talk. Why not? You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're available at heritageradionetwork.org. You can get a hold of us that way via the web. How are you listening? Again, we've got a phone number, old school, 718-497-2128, if you feel like dialing up. Hey, I got a phone. I have a smartphone. I'm of the age where I have a smartphone, and my smartphone is so much smarter than me. I, like, don't use it for anything. I don't even know why. I almost feel like if they made flip phones, I'd go back to buying it. I've got this iPhone that's it's the greatest technology in the world. It's just wasted on me. You know, the NSA is looking at my phone going, what's this guy do? He doesn't even carry it around with him half the
right.
time.
Right. They're not even recording you.
They're not. He's like, I'm like a deadline on the graph. I want to give a shout out to a restaurant, because this is a Eugenia's going to stay with me for this next segment for sure. But one of the things I do, I've got a PBS show. If you don't know who you're listening to, that's fine. Just stay tuned in. You'll figure it out. But I'm a chef all my life, and then luckily went into the food media by happenstance, because really food media didn't exist for most of my culinary career. Thank God it does now, because it beats the heck out of spending 7 days a week standing in clogs behind the line. But I'm a huge fan of chefs and their passion, and restaurateurs and cooks and home cooks, professional cooks. And I've got a PBS show that has been on in New York on Channel 13 for a dozen years. We're shooting our 13th season now. If you've never seen it, we're on Sunday afternoons at 3:30 here on Channel 13 and also in New Jersey on their public affiliate, which numbers vary depending on where you are in the state, but that's NJTV and LIW as well. So we sort of cover the map from Montauk out to Hartford, from here out to Albany. Been a great show, and I'm a champion of chefs. And I was just in, it's funny, a friend of mine called me up and said, you've got to try this restaurant that opened up about 4 months ago. A couple of great players. Eamon is the front of the house guy, worked at a Terra. Great restaurant downtown, has a really solid resume. He might have been at 11 Madison Park. Bryce, his chef, was at 11 Madison Park for a while. And they opened up on 57th Street off of 6th Avenue. And it's funny, Eugenie, as you're sitting next to me, you know, I've lived all over Manhattan. So I've lived in, since 1982, I've pretty much lived everywhere, as most people did. I just moved around a lot, rentals. Owned in Kips Bay, but then sold that to buy my restaurant in Cape May. And I just recently moved from the West Village to the Lower East Side, where I bought a co-op on Grand Street down there in Co-op Village. So I've been downtown for 10 years. I've been in the West Village and now the Lower East Side. And I don't go north of 14th Street or 23rd Street unless I really have to. There's like, I mean, which is really horrible because, you know, New York's the greatest city in the world, and we have this like zip code bias. We're downtown.
Yeah, you get a nosebleed if you go above.
You need a passport. You got to like change your clothes or something.
It's
so
ridiculous, but
so these guys open up on 57th right off of 6th. And I'm like, oh, you know, what are you going to do? What are you doing up there? I mean, there's a lot of money. There's a lot of business. Anyway, congratulations to them. The name of the restaurant's Betony, B-E-T-O-N-Y. I know that their opening wasn't super smooth like a lot of restaurants. You're up there in kind of a corporate district trying to do amazing food, and not just trying, they're doing amazing food. But just September, I don't know if I read the review in Poland or if I read the review when I got back, but great 3-star review from the Times that did what those reviews will do, which is put a restaurant in orbit. So the place goes from being sort of 2/3 full or half empty some nights. Mm. So you can't get a table now for 3 weeks out or 4 weeks out. Really, really one of the best meals I've had in a while. A couple of the dishes came to mind. One was this really beautiful slow-cooked short rib that he had. And I know everybody does braised short ribs. And it's like, yeah, what? This was spectacular. And then he had a lobster, which is something I usually don't order. Like, I'm not a big – I like crab meat. I love clams and mussels. I mean, lobster to me is this sort of overrated protein. The best part to me is always that knuckle meat that connects the claw to the body. The tail to me never tastes like much. But this is a fancy restaurant. You have to have lobster. And it was just this lobster tail. I don't remember the sauce per se, so I'm not going to geek out on it. But what I remember most of anything was that it was – almost half raw. It was barely cooked. It was so good. I mean, it was almost, I mean, I'm going to say it was half cooked. It wasn't cooked all the way through, and it just tasted great. So, yeah, wonderful wine list, wonderful service, great. So shout out to my boys up on 57th Street. And if you haven't been and you feel like an occasion, it's a bit of a fancy place, but Betony is a great spot Let's go back to mushrooms. Again, my guest is Eugenia Bone, who, among other hats, is there actually a day job? Is there something you do besides have fun?
Oh, no, it's volunteer. Oh, you mean besides have fun?
Yes,
you know, you know, I'm a writer. So I don't really have a job, but I angst over it anyway.
Yeah, you're a writer. That's right. Yeah, writers, especially these days, man. Writing is just, you know, who gets paid, right? But it's what it is. But you've got some books out.
Yeah, I've been around.
Yeah. So I think you turned me on to a great mushroom spot. I used to shop, when I lived in the West Village, I watched the Chelsea Market really go from being sort of hit and miss and half good to half junk to just really a full-on amazing market. I think the best retail fish store in the city is the Lobster Place.
Yeah.
And the headquarters of the Lobster Place is in that market. Incredible fish, incredible prices, incredibly fresh. Dixon's Farm Stand, if you're looking for sustainable local New York meat, heritage breed pork, just a great program. They've got a chef there named Dave that does all sorts of pâtés and confits and plays around. I think they make their own hot dogs. That was great. Of course, Amy's Bakery, Sarah Beth's, Bonitalia. But buried in the back there is that Manhattan Fruit Exchange, and you see their trucks all over the place, and you think of them as wholesalers. Well, that used to be one-stop shopping. I could get my protein at one of the aforementioned places.
Exactly.
And then you actually said that's one of your go-to places for mushrooms in the city?
Absolutely. They have the best selection. It's still not like the Berkeley Bowl or something, but it's very good, very fresh, and they usually have a couple of bins of wild mushrooms. The wild mushrooms I would recommend to look for are the hedgehogs, which have a little, they're a tooth fungi. They look like chanterelles, but instead of having gills, they have little furry teeth. Or the chanterelles, there are good deals. I've also gotten great deals from morels there, but that's only in the early spring, depending on weather. And sometimes I've bought winter chanterelles, which I'm not really positive where they come from. Oh, I've bought black trumpets I love.
I know, and you could get
they're
those.
They're really goth, and they pickle beautifully.
They pickle beautifully, and I remember eating at Fatty Q, Zach Palacio's smokehouse on the Williamsburg side of the Williamsburg Bridge, kind of tucked underneath it. And there was a dish there that Zach has. Now, he's moved upstate now. That's where that's where his new restaurant is, actually, which is supposed to be fantastic, by the way. I have not been up to try it yet, but Zach made a dish for me there that was just beautiful with fresh house-made ricotta, a little bit of egg yolk, barely set eggs, and put on a piece of toast with a ton of black trumpets that he brought from his upstate residence. So those are, again, local New York mushrooms.
Oh, yeah. They're easy to find. I mean, they can be hard to see because of, you know, leaf litter and so on, but we hunt them is up until a frost.
Good
They're fabulous. They're wonderful pickled. I actually like to pickle them and then toss them with home canned tuna, which I do whenever I get a nice big hunk of tuna.
So how do you? I can't believe I don't do any of this stuff, and I'm a chef.
So easy.
So what? So you're getting albacore tuna, that sort of local, or it doesn't matter what kind of tuna you're using.
I have no idea.
Okay.
What it is that, you know, my husband's an architect, and this one contractor he works with, he likes to fish off Montauk. And every once in a while, he goes, hey, Kevin, I got a nice big piece of tuna. And he brings it over. Joey, he's fabulous. And the tuna's wrapped in all these bloody paper towels. It's so divine. And so it's a hunk, like the size of a child's head. And he brings it over, and I eat some of it raw right away, usually with like a little scallion paste or something simple. And then can up, do 2 to 4 little half pints. I use a pressure canner. You have to use a pressure canner for low acid foods, vegetables, and proteins.
So a pressure canner is like a home retort.
A home what?
Well, you know, a retort's a commercial thing. That's how they do canned. That's how you do exactly what you're talking about. So if you're trying to get something like sardines or anything like that, tuna has to go through something where you have heat and pressure.
No, it's not because of the what it is that you need to have a certain
temperature for X amount of time.
Well, and what happens is you can boil it if. When you use a boiling water bath, that temperature at sea level is only 212 degrees.
Yeah, it's all water will do.
But to kill the spoilers that can exist in a low-acid food like tuna, you need to increase the temperature. And the way to do that is with pressure, steam pressure.
And the lid bottle down so nothing's escaping.
Yeah, I mean, a pressure canner freaks people out because they think it's going to blow a hole in their ceiling.
I think my mom had a pressure cooker once that
Not a cooker, a canner, right? Yeah, cooker's okay. a different deal.
Okay, I think she did have one of the things. I think it did canner. Blow up in the ceiling once. Nah, so this canner thing is something you buy
they're
once?
They're very safe now. They're okay. really, well, no, you know, I got a few of them. You get into it. It's sort of like, I don't know, buying bicycles or something. Once you have one, you think, wow, I need another.
I'm that way with guitars.
But. Yeah, okay, there you go. Yeah. I mean, I have a couple of different ones and different sizes. So I have this one beautiful little All-American that holds five pint jars at a time. And so I'll put in 5 pints of mixed things. Like I might do carrots and I might do another vegetable as long as they process the same amount of time.
Right.
Just crank it on.
So there's water in it? What is in there? There's water in it?
There's a few inches of water in the bottom.
Right.
You crank on the top. You have to vent, steam.
And it's a lid that's sort of literally cranked on. It's clips. There's things to fasten.
There's different styles. Okay. There's usually a gauge. There's some are gauge types. Some are weighted gauge. Some are visual gauges, mm-hmm. you know, that have the pressure on it. At sea level, we're going to do 10 pounds of pressure. And the time varies based on the product. And there's a lot of USDA data that you can use as a guideline. That's what I use in my books and in my life. Well, no. In my books, I use USDA data, but sometimes I kind of stretch it in my personal life. And try some things of which there is no data for.
So tell me about the tuna. So this chap comes, delivers to you a big hunk of loin of tuna, which you'll immediately eat fresh that day raw, you'll saute some the next day, but at some point you're
make
thinking
a sausage thing. Yeah, and then with the leftover I'll make pack it into a little jar.
In like a jar with a lid. So a sterilized jar with a sterilized lid.
You don't have to sterilize it. You only have to sterilize something that's gonna process for less than the amount of time it takes to sterilize in the first place,
it's living,
would be 10 minutes.
If it lives through that. So then is the tuna in oil? What do you pack the tuna in?
I like to put it in oil, but you can put it in water. Tuna is the only fish that you actually add liquid to. Like when I can salmon or trout, I don't add liquid because they extrude so much liquid of their own. But I also can beef stew. I can my chicken broths. I have 5 half pints I just did the other night. It takes 20 minutes at the pressure canner. That's at 10 pounds of pressure to can chicken stock. Fabulous.
Where do I buy these canners? Where do I go to get one of these things? You're going to get
online,
me doing this.
All American, but you have to. It depends if you have a gas stove or if you have ceramic. It depends. It varies which type of canner.
Right. Induction would need something else. So All American, what? What's the website?
Well, All American is the name. It's, I guess, allamerican.com or whatever. You know, it's All American, but there's also Presto. That's another good company.
Presto canners, okay.
And I just like the reason why I'm partial to All American is because it's got a gauge that I can read, and it's got a weighted gauge, which you you learn how much pressure is in the pressure canner. You know, how much, what maintenance of pressure there is based on these rattles. You know, it goes, and that's how you know that everything's going fine. If it's rattling all the time, that means that your pressure's a little high. And if it's not rattling at all, that means your pressure is low, that kind of thing. Mm. But there's also a visual gauge that says 10 pounds. Mm. And it doesn't have the All-American that I use is small, so I can actually have a pressure canner going at the same time as I'm boiling pasta for dinner on another burner.
Right. Makes sense. I mean, you do all this multitasking together. Once you're in the kitchen, you're in the kitchen.
Yeah, that's the way. Yeah. I think that's the way to do it. Otherwise, you know, I mean,
otherwise, it's a chore. I know, it's funny.
It's like fun, but who wants to be neurotic about it?
You know? And it's weird. You know, we live in this time when I mean, we talked about the dark ages that I lived through, the sort of 60s and 70s, late 50s, 60s, 70s, even the 80s in America when it was just pitiful. And now we've become sort of food obsessed as a culture. There's several networks that have nothing but food channels all day long. Of course, PBS invented it, and PBS has their cooking blocks on the weekends and some weeknights. We've got all these magazines. We've got everybody's so into it. And yet, the irony of it is that people are actually cooking less at home than ever, which is crazy. Maybe the younger kids are cooking more. I hope so. I mean, that's my hope. But when they tease out the information, you know, people like to watch. They like to be entertained by food, but it's really the actual idea of rolling up their sleeves, putting an apron on, pulling a cutting board out, getting a sharp knife, and doing something. Apparently, we spent more time cooking at home a generation ago than we do now, which is crazy.
Well, I think it sucks to not be good at something right away. I personally find that it sucks not to be good at something right away. And the trick, the reality of cooking
practice,
is
practice, right? You get better at it.
And the reason why, it's maybe the reason why I think I got better at cooking is because I had to. I didn't have any money for a really long time. I mean, I learned to cook on a hot plate and with a toaster oven because I didn't even have a kitchen. I just had this cruddy loft in Tribeca that we lived in. It was the pits. Mm-hmm. So that's how I learned to cook, you know, and I had to because I was broke, you know. So I think that once people kind of accept that reality, then they're experienced, they have a real motivation to develop their technique. And once you get good at it, it's very rewarding. And,
yeah, I mean,
you know,
chefs love. I mean,
they're very happy. Except you never get invited anywhere for dinner. That's the
Because people get intimidated. But the truth. I mean, every chef I talked to was drawn into it. For the most part, was drawn into it pretty young. You know, 13, 14, 15, by getting a job in the kitchen and just really sort of liking that, the vibe, the process, the idea that you're starting with these pile of things that you're turning into something very different hours later that's going to be someone's meal hours after that. And if by chance you had a bad day in the kitchen, the next day you could just do better. Yeah. I mean, that's what I always thought was some nights if you had a rough service and it just didn't go well, well, your stoke was to get back in there the next day
and
just do it perfectly.
Well, you guys are adrenaline junkies too.
Well, you have to be. Crazy. Yeah, chefs have to be. It's a kid's game. You brought me something here. What do we have in this jar? This is too kind of you.
And so I'm you wanted to talk about pickles a little bit. And even though I do pickles, I don't do a lot of them. I do more marinated stuff, and I only do it if there's a good USDA. It tastes good? Okay, so those
so
are
good.
Those are actually Bellitis edulis, which are the king Bellitis, the best of the porcini group. And I collected them in the West Elks, where, as I was saying earlier, we had a fantastic season this year. The West Elks, the Rockies. And so this is just a marinated, which is like a light pickle. And I like to do marinades to the extent that I have a good data for processing. I prefer marinades over pickles when it comes to vegetables because they're easier to use. Something that's super sour is very hard to use in a lot of recipes, whereas something that's marinated, it's really flexible.
Plays well with
others.
So
I can dump those porcini. I can brown a bunch of chicken and just dump one of those half pints of porcini mushrooms in the marinade right on top. I don't even have to drain them.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to.
And that's it. I'm done.
It's beautiful. And the texture's amazing. It's really meaty, really creamy.
Yeah, the porcini is a really fabulous mushroom. You have to take those home because I got about a zillion of them at home.
Something tells me
I found a lot of mushrooms.
Find a way onto the dinner table tonight.
When it comes to pickles, there's only a few that I really bother to do because I'm not a huge, I mean, I make sauerkraut, and of course I'm eating sauerkraut before every meal in the hope to lose a little bit more weight. But I definitely make every year pickled onions because I'm a Gibson drinker.
That's good.
Yeah.
Well, you got to garnish it with something. You may as well make it out
of
a homemade.
You know what? I don't even really eat the onions. I use them in tacos and stuff like that. It's just the pickle juice that I'm interested in. And it's gotten to this sort of bad point where I go to a bar or a restaurant and I order I like vodka martini, so I have a vodka martini with no garnish.
Nothing. Right.
And then I bring my own pickle juice. Yeah,
no
yeah. And I supply various menopausal girlfriends too. It's really useful.
Have you talked to anyone about this?
No, I have not. Should I? I mean, I just try to be subtle because I don't want to insult the restaurant. But I have all these little containers. I just shoot a little bit of that pickle juice in. And what's so good about it is it tastes like onion. It has the vinegar, of course, but it's the sweetness because you add a little sugar to it that it seems to compensate for what the vermouth should be doing but doesn't seem to do.
Mm.
And so, yeah. The juice, actually, from pickles is one of my favorite products to have on hand.
You could sell. You know, isn't there a company that started where the guy was making bitters in his apartment in Brooklyn, and now he's all over the place? I mean, there's a market for
bitters
that.
Bitters are easy to make.
Yeah, and mixologists are really into these sort of geeked-out ingredients.
Yeah,
stuff,
they're fun to make.
Ton.
You just have to, my feeling is, figure out what it is you like to drink. Like, my husband and I went through this whole.
I drink Negronis. I drink one thing.
Oh, okay.
So it's pretty simple. And now I can get great vermouth like Carpano Antico. They've got gin has gone through a renaissance.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, there's a billion types out there. And Campari is just the standard. I mean, it hasn't changed in years except maybe the coloring agent. But it's equal parts, stirred over rocks, little burnt orange garnish, and you're beautiful.
Yeah.
Since Jump Street. Yeah, Negroni is what I do.
Yeah, I know a lot of Negroni drinkers.
Yeah, it turns out. You know what?
It's a tribe.
It's a tribe, and for the longest time, I don't know how I stumbled into it, because I guess I'm Italian, and Italians love that weird bitter thing. Like, the Italians have all those weird sort of amaros that people would have after dinner that were just made out of artichokes or thistles or who knows what the recipe was. It was very regional.
Yeah, yeah.
So I didn't mind bitter. I've never minded. I like bitter vegetables. I eat arugula and dandelions and chicory and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, verdura trovata is what the Italians
love. Like, that always love it. So I sort of stumbled into Negronis 25 or 30 years ago, and really for the better part of two decades, I would go to New York restaurants and ask for a Negroni, and either they'd say, "We can't make it," and I'd say, "Yeah, you can," or they would send me Americano, which is a mistake. It's another drink that's similar, but it's not the same. And then in like the last 7 or 8 years, like, Negronis saw their day here in the city. It was like a renaissance. It was like
finally, you could get a good one.
John Benno's restaurant in Lincoln Center called Lincoln had a full-on Negroni program where he had like a dozen different varieties of gins, of vermouths, of, instead of using Campari, using other, and he just played around with this idea of those flavor combinations. Yeah. And I was like, how did, you know, it was like my little bastard child suddenly became class president or something.
Yeah,
like, really?
Yeah,
it was great to see it. It's nice to see it. And then it turned out lots of sommeliers, lots of people that are in the business, actually, that was their little, that's their drink too, because it's just so, it has so many flavor layers going on at so many levels because of the botanicals and the gin. No one knows what the hell's in vermouth, and the same thing with Campari. It's just layers of stuff.
You know, I think it's, if there's something that you like my husband and I went through this period where we were drinking a lot of old fashions. I guess it was because it was during, I think, the Bush Kerry debates, and we were so depressed. So we started watching this movie. It's a mad world, right?
Right, like 60s.
And so there's this scene where this is drunken pilot who leaves the controls of the plane in order to make an old fashioned the way granddaddy used to make it. And so we started drinking these old fashions, but that led to me making orange bitters, which is like a shortcut to making old fashions. And I made the orange bitters kind of for as long as I was into the old fashioned thing. I moved on, you know, to the Gibsons and so on. But that's sort of the kitchen ecosystem idea, is to pay attention to what you're eating and start making. I mean, that's kind of what I advocate and what I like to do. And I think it sort of ties into this whole canning phenomena.
So tell me one more time, you're listening to Mike Colomeco's Food Talk on Heritage Radio Network, heritageradionetwork.org. My guest has been and will be for the next minute or two until we sign off, Eugenia Bone. You have a book out on mushrooms now, but your book that is not out yet, tease it for us. Who's the publisher? You have a deal?
It's Clarkson Potter. Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
Clarkson
no,
Potter's
it's
great.
400 plus recipes. It's a monster. And it's called The Kitchen Ecosystem.
It'll be out next summer.
And comes out, next summer.
And so this discussion, and we're going to have you back on this as a frequent flyer guest here, because you're always so much fun to talk food about. But so all this stuff about canning and pickling and jarring, everything we've talked about today, will actually have like the tutorial with the recipes on a piece of paper
of
in
course.
That book. Okay.
Of course, of all course. Right. Yeah. Because, you know, I'm doing it all the time. So even though I'm not really drinking old fashions right now, I still have the bitters recipe in the book.
good. We could use it. I'm stoked. Hey, couple of weeks, Halloween's coming up. I'm just curious. Do you get many in your, where are you, in Soho now?
Yeah.
Do you get kids coming by for Halloween?
Oh, no, not really. Just adult children all over the neighborhood.
Yeah, I'm wondering what's, because I used to actually get out of town that time I was in the Village, because it was kind of a nutty night in the West Village. But I wonder if I'm going to get a lot of people. I live down on Grand Street now, down in Co-op Village, and there's this wonderful, you know, Economy Candy? Have you been there?
Yeah, of course.
Is that place not the, I remember walking in there for the first time and just like going, you're kidding me. I mean, it is the, it's like candy paradise.
Yeah, if you go there and tell them, I had such and such a candy on my travels in such and such a country.
And they don't have it, they'll order it.
They'll get it for you.
Yeah, I met the owner today. I think his name is Jack Cohen. I knew he was the owner because he just got it, something just got delivered, and he was the guy that was cutting open the boxes with a box cutter and stacking them. Older guy, my age, I guess, whatever that means. And I said, you're the owner, right? Because, who else would do this? And I got to tell you, I love your store, man. How long have you been here? I've been here forever. He takes me outside. Because that's my dad, that's me, and now my son's taken over the business. That is such a classic. I might have him on the show for Halloween, actually, because we're going to be live that
day. That's a great idea.
Yeah, he's great. And there's another guy, and I want to give a shout-out to Joe Mart Chocolates in Brooklyn here in Kings County. Michael Rogak and Joe Mart is really one of the last of the old-school Brooklyn candy makers, who's another great story. Mm-hmm. And not surprisingly, of course, I asked the guy at Economy, so you have any chocolates from Joe Mart? He says, yeah, everything in this glass case is from Joe Mart. So it's like all the stuff that's dipped and all the nutty rolled stuff, fresh-looking stuff comes out of Joe Mart. And Joe Mart is another third-generation chocolate guy from back in the day when Brooklyn's making stuff again.
Yeah.
But that time we talked about those sort of the dark ages, you know, Brooklyn just became this sort of, you know, forgotten, ghettoized borough of the city where people that couldn't afford Manhattan lived. There wasn't a lot going on. The factories had closed. Food production was over. It had moved elsewhere, and Joe Mart's really one of the last of the great vestiges of the of Brooklyn candy making, so those guys are going to be fun. All right, we're going to wind it down. I believe, I'm looking at my clock, it's getting close to an hour, boys. I want to thank everybody here. Jack, thank you. Jack runs the show from the control room. Eugenia, thanks for coming out.
Glad
you and I will
here.
Take the L train back to where old folks go.
Let's go.
Yes, the retirement community, otherwise known as Manhattan.
Yeah.
Folks, we'll be live. This is a weekly show. We'll see you next week. That's every Thursday between 4 and 5 o'clock on Heritage Radio Network. The show is Mike Colomeco's Food Talk. I'm your host, Mike Colomeco. It's a pleasure, and I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.